From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and I'd like to start our program today with a few numbers.
We'll start things off tonight with the number 24. Right after that, America, we have 52. Now your next number up tonight is 40. That's followed by 22, and we'll round it out tonight with 64. Now for your winning Powerball number, good luck everyone, it is 10.
Those were the numbers that won a ticket holder in California a jackpot of more than $1.7 billion in Powerball last Wednesday. So what's your lucky number? That's a question a lot of people have been asking themselves in the past few years as jackpots and lottery games like Powerball and Mega Millions reach new heights. And those jackpots are just a drop in the bucket. In 2020 alone, state lotteries in America made more than $91 billion in ticket sales. Modern state lotteries in America started out in the 1960s with bold promises for the states that created them. And then when the economy took a downturn later in the 20th century, those promises extended to players who've been offered jackpots that get higher by the year. For both the states and the vast majority of players, those are broken promises. And even through all of that, we are still, as author Jonathan Cohen puts it, a jackpot nation. That was illustrated in some messages we got yesterday after we sent something to our texting group. For one, Jacqueline in Rock Island texted to say, "I don't know, I kind of like the lottery. I sure wish I'd win it. My mom has always played when the numbers get big, and after a crummy day, it's kind of nice to go buy a ticket. It brings a feeling of hope and happy-go-lucky that regular life lacks." And then there's this voicemail we got.
"Hi, I'm Julie calling from Galesburg, Illinois. The fixation on Americans winning the large lotto jackpots, well, come on, you guys. You got to figure we all have a dream. And that's it. It's the dream. You know, I don't know that it would change our lives for the better, but we all have that dream. Think we want to try. That's all."
Yeah, $1.7 billion would certainly change your life. All right, Jonathan Cohen wrote about all this in a book that came out last year. It's called For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. It's available from Oxford University Press. Jonathan Cohen, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, and for the record, I'm here because I didn't win that lottery either. So I'm just going to keep doing these interviews until I do, I guess.
Well, if my bosses are listening, I would do this job even if I won the lottery. So one more number or a set of numbers, and though it is 800-222-9455, or put another way, 800-222-9455, which is not the lottery number but our phone number if you want to join our conversation. What do you think of America's fixation with huge lottery jackpots and maybe how the lottery has changed our state and our country? Would we be better off without it? Again, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Jonathan, I want to start with another message from a listener. For some of us, I think, you know, the lottery is an idle pastime. Even knowing the odds, we'll still find ourselves maybe every few months buying a ticket for a big jackpot. But that's not the experience of a lot of Americans. And Gene from Champaign talked about, quote, "The people I see standing at counters buying several lottery tickets appear to need to be spending their money on life's necessities instead of wasting it on dreams which have an almost impossible chance of ever happening." So I guess, Jonathan, my first question to you is, broadly speaking, what do we know about who plays the lottery and why they play it?
Sure. We know a lot to answer this question, and we know that the disproportionate share of lottery tickets, as much as 70 to 80% of all lottery tickets sold in this country, are bought by the top 20 to 30% of lottery players. So it's a really small group that's buying, you know, a large share of the tickets. And that group, that 30% of lottery players, is disproportionately lower income, non-white, less educated, and male. So, you know, on the surface, the lottery looks exactly like, you know, the common phrase, the common idea that it's a tax on people who are bad at math, or it's a poor tax or something like that. I sort of disagree with that because of the answer to the second part of your question, which is why they're playing, which is, I don't think these people are buying tickets because they don't understand how probability works and because they, you know, they failed the high school statistics class. I think they're buying for the reasons that some of your listeners have already laid out, which is the opportunity to dream, the offering by the lottery of something that is not available elsewhere in the economy, which is a way out and a way up. And, you know, for just a small investment, the chance to imagine a life, a whole new life and a life of opulence.
You know, it's often talked about the origins of the lottery, and we still hear that in Illinois, how it benefits education. And you mentioned in the book that this idea, it's come up in lottery advertising, that even if you don't win, everybody wins because education gets money. And we got another text from one of our listeners, Julia in Kenny, Illinois, who said, the lottery was originally supposed to greatly benefit state public education, but I don't feel that it really does. Tony in Harvard touched on a point that comes up in the book. He said, quote, I'm still amazed by the way state legislators handle lottery revenue, promising the revenues would increase school funding and then decreasing school funding by the lottery money for zero net gain. I know there's a lot of nuance to this discussion, but Jonathan, what do you make of what Julia and Tony had to say? Generally speaking, what do lotteries mean for the states that have them?
Yeah, they mean not nearly as much as people think they are. And Julia and Tony have it exactly right. On average, lotteries raise 1, maybe 2% of total state revenue or total state government. And exactly as Tony said, in states like Illinois, and this has also been the case in Florida and California, New York, Virginia, Colorado, where the state, for every lottery dollar that's appropriated to schools, a normal dollar sort of from the general fund would disappear. So resulting exactly as Tony said, in no net benefit, no net gain for education whatsoever. The real problem here is sort of what Julia laid out, which is this perception that the lottery is helping schools. And this is where we sort of have two hands, sort of that one, they don't know what the other one is doing. Where on the one hand, the Lottery Commission is out there advertising all the good it's doing for schools because it sees that as a great sales tactic. Oh, people will buy more tickets if they believe that they are doing a civic good. And then lo and behold, all the state legislators in Springfield are sort of scratching their heads saying, we don't have nearly as much lottery money as the lottery is saying we do. And people are sort of getting mad at us for not doing more to help education. But really, fundamentally, the lotteries is not a big enough source of government revenue that it could offset taxes in a significant way. So again, the lottery has every incentive to tell people that it's doing a lot of civic good, even when that is not, in fact, the case.
So I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that the modern state lotteries, as we know them, are not all that old, but the concept of a lottery goes back hundreds of years. So how do lotteries make their comeback in the 20th century here? You know, why do they come back? Why do they become a government project?
Yeah, we have about 6 hours, right? So let me just start as far as back as I go.
That'll be for the podcast extra.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Everyone's donate to your local public radio station for 6 hours of content on lottery history. I mean, lotteries as an idea, sort of the drawing of lots is ancient, right? Dating back to the Bible and beforehand, but sort of the modern iteration that you're talking about, which is of the use of lotteries as for civic purposes, right, to fund government in some capacity. There's a little bit of that in ancient Rome. The sources are a little bit unclear, but it might have been something that was used also in ancient China. But sort of the modern version, modern, you know, in quotation marks, dates back to about 15th century Italy, which was sort of the first time it was sort of recognizable in this form. It makes its way to England. It makes its way to the colonies and to North America, where it's sort of used to build infrastructure for the 13 colonies. And then it goes underground, and famously in Chicago, the game of policy becomes extremely popular in the African-American community and sort of basically goes through these waves of repression and legalization for the first 200 years or so of the nation's history. And then, as you said, in the 1960s and 1970s is this sort of reemergence of this new wave of legalization where we find ourselves today.
Is there a benefit to the government taking it over? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, if you have mafia involvement or something, that can be a dangerous game at times, perhaps.
Yeah. Yes and no. There definitely was a lot of mafia related violence and probably just as much, or maybe not quite just as much, but definitely a lot of, you know, poor people spending more money than they could afford on illegal lotteries, you know, in the early 20th century as there is now. So there definitely is a benefit there. There are a lot of harms, though, and a lot of reasons why I think, you know, it's just the government should not be in the lottery business in the way that it is today. First is that, especially in African-American communities, the lottery really used to be a community institution where those who ran the games would make a point of sort of reinvesting large percentages of their profits in the community, where it was sort of a lower odds of winning, but you'd also win smaller prizes. But folks, it really was sort of a more effective redistributive mechanism in the community versus what we have today, right? Which is much longer odds and money that is sort of disappears into state coffers, never to be seen again. And then the other real problem, and this is where you take me back into a time machine and I get to have an hour debate with a Illinois state legislature from 1973, they would say, you know, there's all this gambling happening anyway. A lottery is just going to capture illegal gambling and take the money and let us, the state, keep it. And the real answer is, what the lottery is actually going to do is not only take all the money from people who are already gambling illegally, but is also going to turn whole new generations and whole new groups of people who would never have thought to buy an illegal lottery ticket and turn them into gamblers. So yes, there are some advantages to the state taking over, but what is in fact happens is a lot more people get in on the game, literally, once it has the imprimatur of state legitimacy.
Yeah, and I feel like we could have a similar conversation about video gambling here in Illinois, which has just vastly expanded the accessibility of slot machines all over right. The state and other things of that. Let's go to the phones again at 800-222-9455. Steve is calling from Chicago on line one. Oh, and I'm sorry, I think we lost Steve, but you know, he wanted to ask about what he said is a desperate situation, right? The American dream has slipped away, and maybe the lottery is people's only hope. Can you talk more about that? You alluded to this a little earlier about one of the reasons why people play the lottery.
That's right. And this is why I actually think it is an unfair characterization to say that a lottery is a stupid tax or a tax on people who are bad at math, which is that I think that we're effectively victim blaming. Right, which is that the people who are playing the lottery, not all of them, but many of them, are down on their luck, or, you know, they have financial security, they have financial stability, but they don't have a way to see a better life. They don't have opportunity elsewhere. And they reason, correctly or not, but they reason that through their work, through entrepreneurship, they have a 0.0 chance of ever sort of getting a better life, of ever buying a house in the suburbs, of ever striking it rich. And the lottery, even if the odds are 1 in 303 million, right? Even if they have insanely small odds of winning, at least it offers some odds. So I think it's really understandable why people would play the lottery and why they would sort of cling to this hope, however distant, that it could be the mechanism by which their life will ultimately change.
And you write about how the economic downturn of the 70s and the 80s really put us on the path towards some of these more extravagant jackpots that we see now.
That's right. And sort of I think that helped set the sort of cultural scene, set the cultural stage for why, you know, how we got on the road basically to $1 billion jackpots. And I think even more recent evidence is that sort of shows what's going on, which is that when the economy goes bad, right, when unemployment rates go up, when poverty rates go up, all sorts of other gambling declines. Horse race betting goes down, sports betting goes down, casino betting goes down, but lottery play goes up because the lottery is a form of entertainment like those other games, but it is also fundamentally a replacement source of mobility. And if people lose a job, they sort of invest all the more in the lottery on the hope of solving their financial problems with a miraculous windfall.
A miraculous windfall, right? And I guess it used to be about maybe you'd, in the early lottery, maybe you could move up a rung on the economic ladder, right? It wasn't life-changing money. It was certainly life-improving money. You take a few more vacations or pay off the house maybe, but not this idea of, you know, joining the sort of Hollywood Wall Street gazillionaire class.
That's right. And as late as 1978, winning a jackpot, which is at the time almost never above $1 million, winning a lottery jackpot wouldn't even put you in the top 1% of Americans by household income and wealth. And it's only in the 80s, you know, tied up with in my argument with, you know, the sort of culture of wealth and Wall Street and the lifestyles of the rich and famous and that whole scene that we get these sort of bigger and bigger jackpots. which look insanely quaint and small now. You know, in 1984, there was a bit, or yeah, in 1984, the Illinois lottery players went crazy over a jackpot of $41 million, that which was like the biggest anyone had ever seen at the time. And nowadays, you know, Powerball, Jack, and Mega Millions almost start at basically $40 million. So we've sort of had this crazy escalation over the last 30 years or so in terms of the scale of lottery jackpots, which I think, you know, it's not a coincidence that around the time that billionaire enters sort of the American cultural and political conversation is around the time we also get our first $1 billion jackpot.
Interesting. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation with Jonathan Cohen, whose book is For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. If you are on the line now, please hold on. We need to take a break. We will get to your calls when we return. More with Jonathan Cohen after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Please stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with the author Jonathan Cohen, whose book, which came out last year, is called For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. It's from Oxford University Press. And if you want to join our conversation, the number to do that is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Anthony is calling in. He's from Moline, calling on line four. Anthony, thanks for the call.
How's it going?
It's going well. What's your question or comment for Jonathan?
My comment is, and I get this not only my own opinion, but when I tell people, you know, like they ask how much is the lot, oh, 500 million or $1 billion. Mm-hmm. You know, the biggest response is, I'd be happy with 100. So why not, instead of having one big winner, have 100 $500.
Okay, I got to say, Anthony, I think it's the audio is not great, but I think I got the gist of it, so I'm going to read it back. Thank you so much for the call. But I think what he's saying is that what if instead of one giant, you know, $1 billion lottery, we had 10 $100 million lotteries, or you know, $110 million. I don't know, my math is going to get it's going to break down here, but or $1,000 million lotteries, would that benefit more people? And Jonathan, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely would benefit more people in that we would, you know, make a lot more millionaires a lot more effectively and a lot fewer billionaires. I think, Anthony, it's a great question and one that lottery commissioners ask themselves all the time, because they used to do exactly that. What we used to have in this country was smaller jackpots that were relatively easier to win. You know, the very first jackpot in this country was actually 9 different jackpots, all of $600,000 each, won by 9 different people in New Hampshire. And then they only gradually over time, basically, did lottery commissions realize that people, meaning the public, meaning lottery players, didn't really care as much about the odds. All they really cared about was the size of the jackpot. And so they tried exactly this for a long time. But clearly, I think it was demand driven, and that the people just wanted bigger prizes, and they were willing, whether they knew it or not, to sort of give up the odds in the process. So I agree with you. I think we should get rid of these sort of massive prizes and split them up a lot more effectively. But the lottery commissions have reasoned that that's going to harm sales. So unfortunately, I don't see it happening anytime soon.
All right, not going to harm sales. People don't care about the odds. I do, just because I find it statistically interesting. I like numbers and things like that. And they really have shrunk over time. So the ticket holder who won that $1.7 billion jackpot in Powerball last week, the odds were something like 1 in 292 million. put that in context, the cliche stat you always hear is you're much more likely to die being struck by lightning, but you're also more likely to die in a vending machine accident or falling into the Grand Canyon or being murdered in the Grand Canyon. And, you know, you see this advertising that really downplays that. And it reminded our producer, Christine, who is working on this segment, of an old joke from the late stand-up comedian Mitch Hedberg. Let's listen to that.
You know, they advertise a casino on a billboard. They always show a picture of a guy winning money. But that's false advertising, because that's what happens at least. Perhaps when they advertise a hamburger, they could show a guy choking. This is what happened once.
All right, so Jonathan, talk more about the odds of the lottery and how it's advertised and, you know, played down, and you know, the fact that maybe people just don't care.
Yeah, I mean, just for the record, I tried in the course of my research to find the approximate odds of being struck by lightning while getting murdered in the Grand Canyon, because I think that would be sort of the closest approximation, and it's just too hard to find. But yes, the odds are incalculable. They are roughly the same as putting an ant onto four football fields, sticking a needle into the ground and hitting the ant is your approximate odds of winning a Powerball or a Mega Millions. But I think, and to go back to Anthony's question, I think what lottery commissions have reasoned is that for people like you and me, you know, someone who's not a statistician, right? It's really hard to understand the difference between 1 in 3 million odds of winning, 1 in 30 million odds of winning, or 1 in 300 million odds of winning, right? 1 in 3 million already feels sort of so distant that it might as well be 1 in 300. But it's really easy to understand the difference between a $4 million jackpot, a $40 million jackpot, and a $400 million jackpot. So because the odds are just already so, you know, are so crazy already, then the jackpot might as well be bigger. And because it's really easy to sort of fixate on that. And there's this sort of common human bias, this overestimation that the odds of good things that will happen to you. So I think what you alluded to, what Mitch Hedberg was sort of joking about is right. Sort of the advertising that's meant to foster this sort of magical thinking and this belief that you are going to defy the odds, that you, Brian, you know, you're the special one. It's somebody's got to win. It might as well be you. But I think a lot of that is our brain doing it for us. And I think just to take a case in point, the most common lottery advertising today in the United States doesn't even have to say anything. All it does is it tells you the size of the jackpot on the side of the on a billboard on the side of the highway, and it lets your brain do the rest. And so I think that's very telling in terms of how the lottery is sort of designed to trick your brain into believing that you have a better chance than you actually do.
Interesting. You know, I wonder if we've been focusing a lot on the big jackpots. I often see people playing scratch-off tickets, which is a different type of game. Can you talk a little bit about the different in psychological rewards that people get from that, maybe, or maybe if there's demographic differences in who's playing those different games?
Yes. Yes. And thank you for bringing that up, because scratch tickets are really the bread and butter for state lottery commissions. On average, about 60 to 65% of total annual lottery sales come in scratch tickets. And basically the other reason, not just because it's only 15% of lottery sales, that we shouldn't talk about sort of Powerball and Mega Millions, is because regular non-lottery players buy those tickets, it is actually the least regressive lottery game. So it's the game that poor people play in the sort of smallest percentage, or I guess rich people play in the largest percentage, because even people who aren't regular gamblers do buy tickets for big jackpots. But it's games like scratch tickets and also the daily numbers, three or four digit games, those are played even at a higher rate disproportionately by poor people, people with lower income, less education. And again, those games, as you alluded to, they do work differently. There is this sort of trend now, what I would call the jackpotification of scratch tickets, where you now get a scratch ticket that has a $20 million jackpot. But really, those games offer a reasonable chance of a small prize. You know, when you spend $2, you win $100. And then better odds, sort of exactly what Anthony was calling for, of winning a big prize. But the prize isn't going to be as big, right? It'll be $20,000. It'll be $50,000. It'll be $1 million rather than 20 million, 400 million, a billion. So yes, the reward structure works differently, and which I think is related to why the demographics look different for the players.
Interesting. And I don't know if you can talk about the odds of scratch-off tickets. I'm sure it varies widely depending on the game, but you had that great analogy of four football fields, a needle, and an ant for the Powerball. I mean, are we talking a backyard and a needle and an ant for the scratch-off, or right. is it what?
So this is sort of the appeal of scratch tickets, right? Whereas for most tickets, your odds of winning something might be as low as 1 in 3 or 1 in 2.5. And something might just be a free ticket, or it might be your money back, but that's your odds of winning something. And your odds of winning winning a big prize, I live in Connecticut. I'll just take some lottery games that I happened to look up recently here in Connecticut. Your odds of winning the big prize of the ticket will be maybe 5 in around 3 million or so. So not terrible. And again, the prizes aren't as big. We're talking maybe $500,000, maybe $100,000. So reasonable, maybe even smaller than a backyard, but with much, much lower stakes as a result.
Let's take another caller. John is calling from Springfield on line 4. John, thank you for calling in.
Hello. I've got a question about the Illinois tax rates on gambling. You mentioned earlier that there is some philosophy that for every dollar gambled is a dollar lost to the income. Well, it's really less than that. It's the state only gets a percentage of every dollar. So why is the tax percentage so low on gambling that really doesn't make up enough money for our schools?
All right. Thank you for that, John. And I don't know, Jonathan, if you can speak specifically to Illinois as much. I know it was a more of a nationwide look that you took in the book, but just about the tax structure and the way that the state gets money from.
Sure. No. As being a diligent interviewee, I looked up the Illinois statistics before I came on. So I'm ready for this one.
Excellent.
I think what John is alluding to is that the lottery is an extremely inefficient way of getting tax money, which is that on average in Illinois, roughly 24% of every lottery dollar goes to the state. The reason it is such a small percentage versus, you know, when you pay your income tax, it's something like 90-95% goes to the state and the rest gets caught up in administration. But the reason it's only about a quarter of every dollar that on the lottery that goes to the state is because the vast, vast majority, as much as 60%, 65%, is going to prizes. And that is sort of the way you get the philosophy being that if we jack up the percentage that goes to prizes, more people will play. So even if the tax rate is a sort of small slice of the pie will be bigger as a result. But again, fundamentally, the lottery is just not efficient. And if we were to have a massive, massive pie, that would create all sorts of other economic problems for the state that would have a real cascading effect. So that is not a desirable outcome either. So it's, again, sort of we've been misled in the percentage of state revenue that can come from the lottery for all sorts of reasons. One of them relates to exactly as John alluded to, is the small percentage of every lottery dollar that actually ends up going to the government versus to prizes or to the administration of the lottery or to the stores that sell the lottery tickets.
So just to remind listeners, we're speaking with Jonathan Cohen. His book is For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. About 5 minutes left in our conversation. You know, we've talked about who plays the lottery. We talked about the state's role in the lottery and how little money it gets compared to what people might expect. Let's take a step back, though. After all this research you've done, all the writing, who would you say the lottery is really for?
Yeah. it's a good way to put it. I think the people who are winning the most, you know, pun intended, from the lottery, not including, you know, lottery winners, which does not include me. I think the people who are the big winners, so to speak, of the American state lottery system today are the companies that print lottery tickets and that run lottery operations for states. I think there's a whole industry that exists off of lottery contracts. You know, the state of Illinois pays a company to print its lottery tickets, to manage its lottery games. You may remember about 15 years ago, Illinois was the first state to experiment with sort of a more fully privatized model for its lottery. Mm-hmm. So I think those are sort of undisputably, if you want to look at someone who is unquestionably winning, so to speak, from this game and is getting exactly what they wanted to and exactly what they expected, out of the lottery system, it would be this sort of small group of niche private companies engaged in these services, because gamblers, as Anthony alluded to, aren't winning as much, or a couple of gamblers are winning a lot more rather than many gamblers winning a lot. As I've said, the states aren't winning as much as they thought they would. And as a result, the general public, the voting public, the non-gambling public also isn't winning as much as they thought they would.
So we had one more piece of thought from a listener I want to share. And this one was by text message from Abby in Urbana, who said, "I think the lottery provides a glimmer of hope to those who financially struggle. I think the lottery also brings people together. The jackpot was huge one year, and the custodian rallied a handful of teachers to throw in on some tickets. We all did. And after dismissal, we sat in the main office talking about our hopes, dreams, and wishes for that lottery money. None of us won, but it was a great moment of sharing that wouldn't have come out any other way. If playing the lottery connects me to other people, then I'm fine with it sticking around." What do you think of that, Jonathan?
I think that's great. And I would have paid large sums of money to be a fly on the wall in that room and to listen into them folks talking about their lottery dreams. I think that's exactly right. And I think in general, my sort of preferred path forward is, yeah, I think we need to get rid of the lottery, but I think the number one thing we need to do is sort of make it less sexy, for lack of a better word, and sort of take the lottery fever down a notch, so that let folks like Abby and others sort of continue to play and to have their enjoyment and their dreams, but to do so in a way that is less harmful, and to do so in a way that doesn't exacerbate problem gambling, to do so in a way that is not as predatory in non-white and lower income communities, but still sort of does give people this chance to dream and this form of entertainment that I do think overall, I'm not against gambling in general, but I am against sort of shoving it down people's throats and putting it online and making it sort of more addictive than it needs to be, in a way that is more harmful than it needs to be. And it no longer serves the common good.
Interesting. So just about a minute and a half left. What practically would that look like? I mean, I guess I'm thinking, is it like tobacco? We don't have billboards and TV ads of the Marlboro Man anymore. It's much more limited in how they can sort of glamorize tobacco. I mean, is that the model you're talking about here?
Something like that. And I say this, you know, with some fear, because it will harm my book sales if this were ever to come to fruition. But yeah, I mean, I think putting, and just for the record, all of these things have historical precedent. You know, I'm not just making up these ideas. These were all things that were common as recently as the 1980s. But having a cap on the size of a lottery prize, so it can't get above, you know, $1 billion, or it can't get above $500 million, limiting the cost of scratch tickets in Texas, you can now buy a $100 scratch ticket. You know, I don't think we need to go above $20 or $30 for a prize. Getting rid of the online lottery, getting rid of sort of online frictionless betting, I think would be a great improvement. And again, these are all things that would let the lottery stick around and let people who want to gamble and who are going to gamble casually, let them do so, but not create sort of new generations of gamblers, not attract young people who aren't supposed to be betting, but many of them are. And also, just in general, as I said before, take the temperature down on the nation's lottery fever.
Jonathan Cohen's book is For a Dollar in a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America, from Oxford University Press. I have to admit that I actually got a hardcover of the book through a Goodreads giveaway, which I guess is my own, probably the closest I've ever come to winning a lottery. Jonathan Cohen, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thanks, Brian. I was going to wish you good luck, but I think you've already got it. So good luck to everybody else.
Absolutely. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st show. Stay with us.